My name is Andy Gordon, and I entitled this second, I think, computer lecture, Computers Versus Education, partly to attract your attention to the subject, but also because there are a lot of very specific things that we can talk about. I'm going to start out with peons praising computers in certain educational situations, but since you can hear a lot of that in advertising and so on, I'm not going to spend much time on it. I want you to be exposed to that side and what the ideology consists of, and I think there are particular things in it that you might find especially useful. I have a computer I was going to use. It's sitting in a chair. I hope it will be the worst listener in the room. I was going to try to demonstrate some things, but when I really took the clock seriously, I figured we wouldn't get there. So if there are demonstrations people would like of what I think are some of the most formidable and interesting uses of computers, we can do that too. But we're caught up in a culture right now where people think that isn't necessary, where more and more resources of a limited set of resources to begin with in education and a lot of other settings are being devoted to high and higher technologies, to computers and computers. California has raising money now through the lottery. That money, it isn't that money can be spent on education. That money can be spent on computerized education. Who's from California? Apparently there are two things. It's computers and something else. But it's very specific. So it isn't that you can use it for second language acquisition or whatever else a particular school might need. It's locked in. Now they have economic reasons for doing that as well. They've got this huge industry in Silicon Valley that James Bond was helping protect in his last movie. But it's a serious issue. There's a lot of money being spent. Now what is it being spent on? Well, let me talk first, give a few examples of what I think are particularly good uses of computers. I'm going to talk mostly about the small computers, but we'll have to segue back and forth to the mega machines to have a good conversation, and I certainly hope we also have time for talk. By giving some examples, several years ago, I love the fact that these machines are portable. I carry them everywhere, even Holden. I didn't know what it meant that the electricity was not reliable here, and it made me a little nervous. But it turned out to be reliable enough. But I carried an earlier portable machine to California. I took it when my 9-year-old running around now was about 4. And I had some pretty good computer-assisted education programs as I understood them at the time, and I'll come back to that a little bit. And he was learning his math tables or something, and we set up something called SuperMath, a very interesting instructional program where a problem comes up on the screen, and you're supposed to respond to it, and it gets increasingly more difficult, and it was clear that he knew his math, and it was very interesting for him. He had, at least at that level, an ongoing enthusiasm for the task. But more than that, I have a cousin who's Down syndrome. He's about my age, but his intelligence, it was less than my son's at the time. Now, he lives at home, and he has done some spectacular things considering, if you take intelligence literally, some spectacular things. He can play the organ, he can even sight read, he reads to a certain extent, but he has a mentality that doesn't progress him in the ways in which we typically ask it in school. We set him up in front of the same machine in the living room, or that is to say, he set himself up. This is not a test. And he sat down and he played with it and he read the instructions. He can read, but he just reads very slowly. But he read it. And not only that, I think it's proper to say there's a characteristic of stubbornness in lovingness and stubbornness in Down syndrome. That's since I have had a lot of experience because of him and others I've met. And he was going to read it, and he was going to read it thoroughly at his pace. When he finished, his parents are getting more and more antsy. Now, the situation is, in one sense, embarrassing because a 4-year-old has just done this, whipped through it. But he's reading it and he's enjoying himself, and the first problem comes up and the problem looks pretty easy, 4 plus 3. And he thinks and he thinks and he thinks and he puts the answer in and it's right. And the machine appreciates it in the very programmed ways these machines can do it, and it moves on to the next question. And after it's quite sure. I know my language is inappropriate, but I don't have time to unpack it. After, the machine is quite sure that he knows this stage, it gives him something slightly harder. Now, what's interesting about the situation is we're sitting around and I'm fascinated, as are my parents and a few other people. His parents are antsy. They want him to get on with it. Well, after he's done two or three of these, we all want him to get on with it. But the computer doesn't. It moves at his pace. It rewards him fully as much when he gets it right as it did anybody else who tried it. It's at this level completely forgiving. It can be individualized. It doesn't care how long it takes. I mean, if I want, as a programmer, I can set up certain criteria and say that's too long. But that's up to me. It's not up to the machine. It can take anything. It can be on all day. So he was totally fascinated. He moved ahead in math tables in a way that he can't typically. And the next time he starts, it remembers where he last was. And that's useful. So in this particular situation with this kid, it's a remarkable device. There's a situation that's a little like that, surprisingly, but it has, not manifestly, but I think abstractly, there are other areas where programs and computers are particularly interesting, and one of them is typing. Typing is a subject that is best completely individualized in exactly this way, because people don't differ with respect to what finger moves fastest and what they have a hard time learning and what they need exercises on. I have with me, as some of my housemates know, some programs that are exactly like that. They not only, because of the way the processor works on the machine, they not only can tell how you're doing, but they monitor every keystroke 60 times a second. So they know, for example, which finger, which is troubling you the most. And then the next exercise is on those things which you need help with. So it's individualized in a way in which it's impossible to do for a teacher to do, even the best teacher in the best classroom. So you can make progress. My son, this same son, knows how to type, and he doesn't know that he knows how to type. It's just set up in such a way that, for example, patterns, D-E-D, and the only way you can get it right in time is to respond correctly. So he learns the motor routines automatically. There are things like that that can be rigidly defined and are very particular, and where you know exactly what the task consists of, where the computer can be, I think, a monumental advantage. There aren't, it turns out, many things in schools that are like that, that are any good, and we'll come back to that as well. So these computers are forgiving, they're interactive, they work at individual speeds, they can be very individualized, and individualization takes on a very different meaning in teaching an adult to type than teaching somebody with Down syndrome how to learn math, and yet the process that allows that capacity is available in all machines now of any size. And they can be made impressive. I mean, they work, they're interesting for a while at least. For a while, by the way, is very important. The studies that have been done about what people learn suffer dramatically, it turns out, from something called the Hawthorne effect. I don't know how many of you know about that, but there's 8 weeks when everybody learns and has a good time, and then it just becomes part of what's going on in the classroom, and nobody particularly learns any quicker with a computer than they did with any other device. So if you introduced a new kind of book, you know, or a clown telling the story, it might have the same impact, and you have to be very careful to attribute that you don't attribute that short-term effect to the particular technology you've introduced. What you've done is get their attention. Once you've got their attention, you've got to hold on to it. And it looks like a lot of what we think of as success, as progress in school, suffers from this deficit. By the way, I put together a collection of readings about things I talked about last week, truth, which were rather different, and a lot of things on computers. I think it's an accessible collection, and you might want to get it. I brought some copies, and they're in the library at what they cost me to make. In the bookstore. There's one called by Derek Bach called "Looking into Education's High-Tech Future." He's the president of Harvard. That's an especially well-rounded piece. There's something I'm going to read from later called "Problems Which Word Processors Cannot Solve." There's another thing called Meta-Mathematics and Metaphysics, which I had the silly assumption that the same people would stick with you and so on. This, we can't talk about this unless you've read it. It's just too compressed, But I recommend it to you. It's a very interesting essay by the man, Hofstadter, that wrote Gödel, Escher, and Bach. It's an essay about why artificial intelligence is not possible. And artificial intelligence, I've decided, is something we can't spend as much time as we want to. And there's an essay by Joseph Wiesenbaum called On Tools that we may spend a little time on if there's time. But they're all things that it's not like what I'm going to talk about. They're not in writing, so a lot of it I'm going to have to leave out just to get through this time at the maddening pace it requires. Okay, now, what I'm giving you examples of are what's typically called CAI, computer-assisted education. The rules for computer-assisted education began with B.F. Skinner, Walden 2. If you like Walden 2, if you like to live in Walden 2, you'd like to be taught in computer-assisted intelligence. But people of you who have read about that and the downside of Walden 2 might also be upset with the consequences. But the logic is that the instructions can be specified. Computer-assisted instruction only works when everything is worked on in advance, when you know what the questions are that you're going to ask, among which a person is going to choose, and you know what the answers are that you're going to accept. And that's that. There's no fuzziness at the edges with computers. Things that operate like that, there's some things called expert systems, are places where you can use computers particularly well. For example, in diagnosing blood diseases, when a person presents certain symptoms, computers are probably as good as the best diagnosticians, as long as the diagnosticians have told them all they know. But it turns out that the level of good diagnosis in a lot of areas, intuition is extremely important. The extent to which people can't describe what they do in a way that the computer can be made to respond to is a deep subject that I wish I had time for, and Bach talks around about a little. But it's a real problem. Computer-assisted instruction only works when everything can be absolutely specified. It requires that. There are a lot of problems with that I'll be coming back to, but I wanted to introduce it that way. This, I'm not trying to leave any... I have not now moved in a direction that means that computers are useless or shouldn't be used or their consequences are only pernicious, because there are other areas where using these, where you can fully form an instruction set, for example, where computers are especially useful. Another place I think where they've been especially consequential is with the physically handicapped. There is somebody in California that typically the computers can be, with the accessory devices built onto them, be made to do a variety of things. There is a person in California who has no control over anything through paralysis in an accident. No control over anything, any movement, except an eyelid. And with that eyelid, he can control a computer. Because the device is connected out of a card on the back to something on his eye. His eyelid moves in all directions. And with that eyelid, and he can see, but he can't talk. He can hear. He's now fully interactive again. So he has on the screen presented to him the alphabet, right? Along with a number of other commands and things alike. And by moving his eye, he can move a cursor over the letter that he wants, blank, and select it. So he can select whole sentences for interacting. And he can write. And he can, but it isn't only letters. There can be a little box down here that says, turn the channel on the television. Or control the lights in the room. Or pick up the phone. So, but again, only those things can be well specified in advance. Well, if specification includes the whole alphabet, and what you're trying to do is write sentences which an English Sprocher can read, you're in good shape. I was at a meeting with Computers and Handicap once with a man who is all deaf and blind and a computer programmer. And he carries around a device that has a typewriter keyboard on it. And when you want to talk to him, he puts his hands on one part of it, and he can sense in his hands the impulses that represent the characters you're typing. So as fast as you can type, he can understand what it is you're saying. Now that's that's computers too. You can't, there's a manifestation of this technology world that, it, in my impression, my reading of the literature, my experience with people is there's nobody this is a greater advantage for than the hand account. These machines have done more to open up the world and the vision, however you want to think about that, than the hand account than anybody else. And that's, I don't want to forget that as we move on to some other things. It's incredibly important. But let's remember again, it's done through a certain kind of rigid logic. And right now, we've identified, I've specified a very small proportion of the population of people in schools, for example, where California is saying that's what you can spend your lottery money on. Now, it seems to me we have to think about some other profound uses of all that new money before we should accept anybody's deciding that's where the computers are, where the resources go. So let me move into some other things that get a little more philosophical, but I think productive, even in thinking about a technology, at least for today. Now, I'm gonna touch on a lot of subjects, and then we can go back and develop any of them that you want to, if we pretend there's time enough. One issue that I want to at least bring up is the whole sense of what knowledge is, and what knowledge has to do with computers. There's quite an essay in part of what Wiesenbaum is talking about, that talks about this. The book that this is drawn from is Computer Power versus Human Reason, or I think it's And Human Reason. Well, what is knowledge? How do we know? Knowledge is more and more becoming defined as that thing which you can put in a computer, or what a computer can respond to. It doesn't deal well with text. As I said, it doesn't deal with things that are fuzzy around the edges. It's a terrible problem. And I'll talk about some of the consequences. The information is picking up at an incredible pace. I saw a wonderful graph that somebody did. Here he graphed the knowledge production over the past 50 years. Okay. Let's say. And here he graphed the evolution of the human brain over the last 50 years. And I think in this context, we might also graph the evolution of human wisdom, except maybe. Right? Now, what do those of us who are on those lines do with that that's handed to us that is on those lines? How do you absorb it? How do you make sense of it? What is from judgment to calculation? The name of one of the chapters in Wiesenbaum's book. What is judgment based on? How much of it is information? How much of it should be information? And in particular, how much of it should be the information that has to be as rigidly defined as I've asserted is going to be in computers. I have a friend that worked in an agency in Washington, and he regularly reported into that agency from here. And most of the way in which they knew what was going on here were reports that were submitted typically in computers, typically in aggregates. So he had this, once he went into the office in Washington, and here was his boss surrounded by, have you seen stacks of output kind of everywhere, on the floor, on the desk, on the table, and this is all information about what was going on in Chicago. And then he sat my friend down and said, and put all that aside and said, can you tell me what's going on out there? That is, he was inundated. There were two problems. There was overload. He couldn't possibly assimilate everything that was allegedly being told. And second, it wasn't what he needed to know anyway, even if he could absorb it. There's also an issue of how the information is presented. There are three, we can develop these later if you want, because I think they're three incredibly important things, but it is the truth. I don't know how many of you in organizations surrounded by a massive output feel more urgently than, and here you are, and here you are, right, with lots of knowledge and no sense of where wisdom or even assimilating the knowledge itself comes into the processing of information. That's a real problem. So there's a resource that that we haven't come to terms with. And if we plot these lines out, we're not likely to come to terms with. It also, there's a question of speed that we talked about in the earlier session that had something to do with truth-telling. we're being pressured by computers to make decisions quicker and quicker and quicker. Star Wars is impossible without it. When decisions are made about whether we have a missile coming in from the Soviet Union, decisions, the information is going to be presented and the president is going to have 2 minutes. What is the president going to do in those 2 minutes? How is he going to figure out whether or not there's a transistor error? How is he going to figure out whether it's in fact a missile, but it's from some subterfuge lieutenant somewhere deep in Siberia and doesn't have anything to do with the government's response? If that's the case, how should the president respond to that versus a deliberate all-out frontal attack from the Soviet Union? Well, the speed at which these things are possible now with computer technology pushing us along is such that humans can't deal with those kind of consequences. So there's something about that. There's one more thing about the resources, if this is a resource, that I want to bring up, and it's this. If the electronic cottage, people working at home, people work with new technology and so on, is worth anything, it isn't going to be built in the ghetto. Things are not being evenly distributed. It does cost something even to get you off the ground. It costs something to get people's attention. This is not a resource that's evenly handedly available, and I'd say that's the good news and the bad news, but it certainly is the news. And we have to think about that as well. So, a distribution issue. Now, because we were talking about the problem with codified knowledge, I'm going to switch. More and more of this will be about educational settings. What are computers comfortable with? They're comfortable with things that are closed off. I told you about that with computer-assisted education. I told you that in particular about things of categories. You have to decide whether you're for it or against it. You have to decide whether whether the diagnosis is based upon sufficient knowledge. You must give an answer. Even in the best of circumstances, the best right now that you can present to one of these diagnosticians is a set of 5 buttons which they push. And that's supposed to be a summary of their decision about whether the blood is dirty, for example. Well, what goes into the computer is not even what went on in that person's head in reaching that decision. It is the 4, that button that they pushed only. So things become more and more codified. That's had tremendous implications still and continues to have growing implications in computer. I'm right, but I was going to say college admissions. Let's call them computer admissions. College admissions. What are college admissions more and more based on? Scholastic aptitude test scores. Why? Because they can be standardized across schools. Because we can instantly at the end of the year tell what the average score was of our entering class, and that's important somehow in thinking about the university. There's a real evolution there. And there are more and more people applying, and besides, you begin to tell yourself, how do you know what somebody's writing when they write a letter of recommendation, et cetera, et cetera. So you're locked into a certain kind of thing that can be assimilated by a computer. But that means people don't read letters of recommendations much anymore, and certainly they don't trust them. It also means that if a student submits an essay or anything else about themselves that either can't be codified or, let's think more generally, that may have even been codifiable but wasn't on the form, it doesn't become one of those things which they can take into consideration. It's having, in that sense, quite a dramatic and, in my perception, assessment, warping effect. Now, people try to break out of that. And I think the most interesting lesson recently is Harvard Business School. Harvard Business School tried to figure out how it should admit good people in business. At least they're thinking about it. And they said, well, we've got these scores on program for getting into business school. GMAT. It's the GMAT. Thank you. Whatever that means. not your fault. But we have to talk in these ways. And by the way, a lot of that are not only things we could hold in our mind, but sometimes we allow ourselves 5 columns to describe something. So it comes down to GMAT. They had that, and they also had essays, and they knew these things were important, and they had letters. But they studied it seriously enough to summarize what happened as hard numbers, hard data drives out soft data. As long as you have the numerical categories, you tend to ignore the rest, even if you tell yourself you're not. It's very frequent. In tenure decisions, you make decisions about how much a person writes. You often get down to how many, because it's much easier to assess how many than how good. And how many compared to this person? Well, in admissions, they were, I think, savvy enough to recognize the problem that the graduate program in business at Harvard no longer asks for nor accepts GMAT scores. They don't want scores. They found themselves unable, in spite of having the rest of this information, to resist focusing their attention on a quantifiable score, so they don't want it. That's, I think, very farsighted and very resistant of things. There's Santa Cruz. Santa Cruz stopped giving grades and started having essay responses to how people were doing in classes, and this is what your what do you get that has all your grades? Transcript consisted of essay comments. Well, and the students loved it, and teachers loved it, and they thought it was much better communication, and they gave it up. And they gave it up because none of their students were getting into graduate school. They wanted to know what their GPA was. They didn't want to read all these damn essays. So resisting the flow toward these things that are more and more codified is tough. And in fact, they gave it up. But Harvard and Santa Cruz are different. It's possible that Harvard will set an emphasis here, a tone. And at least they're up to something that I appreciate learning about some of these things.
Andy? Just a quick comment on the other side of that. That is what Harvard is doing. You know, they get rid of the score. The other side of that is, from my own experience, when I graduated from what was then a not very well-known undergraduate university, Valparaiso University, and I wanted to go to a, quote, good graduate school, I got into the graduate school I wanted to because I had a certain score in the GRE.
Right.
And I know that because I asked the dean or the head of the department I got there, and he, you know, letters of recommendation from my school in the men's bunch because they don't know these people. They know the people at other, quote, good schools.
Right.
So I might have been excluded without that, quote, higher data.
There are always two sides. And I think that, I think, though, a lot of that can be expressed in letters if letters were taken seriously. And I only want to make the general point that if you've got something that looks like a good enough summary, especially if you've got an overload of applicants for X, you tend to settle on that number. I think the consequences are multiple. I'm going to move on to a few other general areas that I want to be sure to have brought up. And they're quite different from one another, but I think they get us on the mark. What does learning consist of? Again, I think Derek Bach's essay is very good on this. We don't know what makes good learning. Well, we don't know what makes good education. We do know that people are more likely to remember a good teacher than they had than a good machine they were in front of. And the consequence I'm observing at our university that I want at least for us to attend to is that people are pulling away from one another. Now that everything can be done on phone lines, our faculty want to be able to stay home and work. Because with a word processor, why do people come to work? They come to work because they have to get a job done. But once they're there, a lot of things happen. The interactions take place. People meet in settings like this. People are forced to have conversations they wouldn't have had otherwise. Well, what people now want to do instead is not be, but hardly any of us thinks about it that way. Mostly we think about the things that had to do exactly with the job we did, even though these other consequences are multiple in communal settings. Well, the computers allow you to be less and less communal. People, the faculty is insisting that they be able to use machines at home. So their time, and we'll be able to deal with that, we'll have office hours, but then the interaction with students is going to be limited to office hours, whatever they are, because that will be the only reason a person needs to be there. People are pulling away because they have work to do. I think it's especially true in universities where people have this tremendous academic publication pressure, but I think it's a more general phenomenon. Now, the other side of that is there are some people that can do their work at home, and that means they are more invested in their family and so on. But I'm trying to talk about the institutional, educational implications of some of these things. in particular. So that, what does learning consist of? Students also want to be home. I've been impressed with a number of people from Portland State who've told me about how they didn't like it because it was commuter college and you were hardly ever there. And who was it that said, was it John Rose? Somebody said that the computer, people spend an average of 6 minutes per day on campus in addition to the time they have to spend in classrooms. Well, we're now going to have that problem in spades because a lot of the education itself will look like it can happen at home. So the likelihood that people will get together, and first the education is going to be limited to those things that are computerizable. That's growing a little, but we'll talk about that some other time. Second, it will happen in a machine. I have students, I have wonderful faculty, a colleague of mine who I cherish as a colleague because of conversations, and I'm frightened by the fact that in his large classes now, he asks for people to ask him questions on the computer terminal. So after a large class, he doesn't want to do it with teaching assistants. He has the right intention in mind. He wants to do it himself, but what he's decided to do himself was to answer the one or two line question he can get from a student and the one or two line response he has available. So he wants to be available to all these people, but what kind of knowledge is being shared? I mean, my sense of him is not a sense of his aphorisms. I mean, you know, it's a sense of his intensive involvement with the students. That's likely to be undercut. Who?
Yeah, there's a real resistance when you do have classes that are just dialogue, too. I have taken some continuing education classes and there's a concept of dialogue.
Yeah, and this lets them not dialogue.
Yeah.
Right. You cut through that not with machinery. You cut through it with... Right, so they feel cut off. Now, I'm not talking about computer nerds. There are computer nerds. That is, people who never could talk to anybody, and now they have machines and they still can't talk to anybody. And I think, in fact, that's typical of sometimes excellent programmers. There's so much going on in their head. They're having a conversation with themselves, and I think we should cherish those too. But then they communicate that in the form of a program they write. It's not those people. I'm talking about the rest of us. I'm talking about those who get these unanticipated consequences and advantages of sitting down in a room together. It's them. It's us I'm worried about, not the computer nerds. I don't know what to do about the computer nerds. I do know, or also whether we should do anything about them. I mean, you know. But I think we might think more about what this does for the rest of us. Where does motivation come from to move on with a project? Can a computer motivate you? I mean, the trouble is the language is there. We talk about individualization, but it turns out to be defined very rigidly in a computer. We talk about motivation, but it turns out to be a flashing light or a good, you know, in color. Well, how long, oh Lord, is that sufficient? So I think the language misleads us because we've taken all those best things about human interaction, and we've given the name to something a computer does, and we say, there, we've got an analogy. What's the problem? The problem is, if you watch it happening, it doesn't look the same, and it doesn't feel the same, and the educational consequences are quite different. Now, I'm going to drop a couple of general subjects. I'm going to mention one other thing that might not have occurred to you that I found very compelling, and it's logic. Libraries to be computerized. Our university is a national leader. We have 85 client universities, including, you know, all the schools that we're supposed to have. Well, what does it mean? It means that there's a certain kind of topic search that you do, and you can find out, for example, what books there are on a particular topic. You can find out whether a book is in or not, again, from home. I don't even have to come into school to find out. But I don't know how many of you have experienced I do, which is the wonder of browsing in a library and the serendipity that occurs. Some of the best examples and insights I've gotten are from books that happened to be in the same room as the book I was looking for. They weren't. I found something in a book. I found a book by Mark Twain on Christian Science that is one of the richest sources of all kinds of metaphors How would I look that up? Well, I was looking on something entirely different. That's gone. Now, I'm sure that this will be responded to by computer people to tell me, I am one. I can respond to myself sometimes. That's that inner conversation I was talking about. That's true. Just describe it to me, and we'll put it in the computer. Well, how do I describe it to you? What do I know what that consists of? And how do I know what should properly be conceptually handed over to a computer? And how do I know where my sense of what relates to what and what's important comes from? Where does it come from? We don't know. Bach, again, is very good on that. He knows we don't know. And it's a source where it's worth hearing it from. So there's libraries. Now, there's a certain, I describe what's happening there as a certain kind of de-skilling, which I'm going to spend some time on. There's this kind of skill that has to do with accumulating and knowing how to learn to know something. That is a skill one learns. How do you learn it? You learn it by testing it. You learn it by finding out what happens when you try it. You learn it by not accepting any, in the best of all computer systems and libraries, there are some categories somebody has set up. So those are the categories I'm poured into. They're more proliferous than the categories of people who might have relied on graduate record scores, for example, but they're categories nevertheless. Hypothesis generation is very difficult on a computer. That is moving to the next level. Again, there's a sense of attempt in artificial intelligence that I plan to have time for and won't, but I particularly recommend to you this article on Metafont and metaphysics, which tries to talk about why artificial intelligence is impossible. It's really quite, you have to get through the whole thing to know where it's like a mystery story, but it really makes the point.
Who wrote that?
It's written by Hofstadter, Roberto Escher and Bach fellow, and it's not in any book. It's from a collection, or it's not in any obvious book. I don't know where I found it. But by the way, I never thought of Hofstadter as writing about computers. I came across this because I was looking for another Hofstadter. Let me talk about this de-skilling thing in a couple other ways. First, at the secretarial level. It's amazing what's happened in offices. I mean, you could imagine that what you're doing is facilitating people's work. And the machine, the word processor, has the potential consequence of doing that. But OSHA did a wonderful study, Office of Safety and Health Administration, is it something like that? Anyway, wonderful study in the same firm. They'd taken some computers and handed them new technology, new kind of personal, on-your-desk kind of computers, and handed them over to bosses and secretaries. For bosses, it was the best thing that ever happened. It allowed them to be creative in a way and to have control in a way that they haven't otherwise. For secretaries, they found the highest stress level they'd ever recorded in an office after they'd been there for several months, including air traffic control. Why was this? Well, there are several things that are going on. First, what you do is, you know, we have this compulsion to be efficient. Efficiency turns out to be, for example, I'm the person who corrects things. So she's sitting at a screen, and every time a page comes up to correct, and she makes all the corrections from a page drawn with page 10 in a 20-page document, hasn't any idea what it is, just mechanical correction. As soon as she's done, the computer knows that, and immediately here comes another screen of things to correct. They're not participating in the process. They're only at a correcting station. And somebody else they know is best at first draft, so that person does first draft and never sees something through to fruition. More than that, remember I said the computer could be used to monitor things 60 times a second and see how well you're typing if you're learning to type? It can also see whether you're up to snuff as a secretary. So in some offices where things are centralized, it can keep track, and every hour something comes up and says, you're a little slow, Martha. Okay, you aren't keeping up the criterion. And what the criterion set against the highest level in the office. So somebody described it as a new electronic sweatshop. So we have, we aren't looking now at the technology, we're looking at some consequences of technology. Again, I love the OSHA study because in the same office you have these incredibly different senses. But we're not pouring this technology into an equalized world. We're pouring it into a world where some people have more power to determine how it's going to be used than others. Now, let me move on to a couple other things related to this. One of them is an experience I had at McDonald's one day. I went into McDonald's restaurant a couple of years ago. And there's a fast food restaurant, and it wasn't fast. Things were very slow. Lines were long. It took me a while to figure out what this might be. It turned out to be that the computer was down. Now think about that just right off the bat. I can't get a hamburger if the computer is down in this restaurant. And nobody seems to be able to deal with this problem. Now the lines are getting long and people are getting upset. Well, in watching this kind of, these accidents are wonderful because sometimes you can see the whole social structure lays there before your eyes in 15 to 20 minutes when there's an accident. Because we don't know how close we live to the edge. By the way, that's another thing that Wiesenbaum talked about. Computers just came along just in time to preserve everything intact. Very nice job of laying that out. I don't think we'll have time to get into it today. Well, here's what I saw. First, it was clear what had gone down were the registers, the cash registers. Now, in a certain sense, that the cash registers are computerized. That's very valuable for the business. They have an instant code at the end of the day of how many hamburgers were eaten, how many french fries were left behind, etc. But remember, here we have this person standing at the cash register. How do they know, what do they do when somebody orders a hamburger? They don't put in $1.49, they punch a button that says hamburger. Right? So one of the first things I learned, though, that these people didn't even know the prices of the things they were selling. Right? There's a certain sense in which it used to be that if you worked in a small business, you learned something about business principles. Right? It was an opportunity to grow. Well, it's not an opportunity to grow anymore. It's been what I call idiotized. They expect this tremendous turnover, and so they're set up for that turnover, and they want to be able to have these press the buttons. And the button doesn't dare to be pressed, and so when people were able to do it by hand, they always had to turn around to see what the price was. I knew the price was better than they did. Okay, second, they couldn't add. If you had two hamburgers at $1.49, they couldn't figure out how much that cost. Right? It was okay for them not to know. The machine didn't require them to know. Remember Milgram, the machine fired them to go on? The machine had intercepted this process in a way that didn't require any skill, including somebody other to step through this, any skill in that area. Third, they couldn't make change. We all learned, remember how, you know, if something cost 32 cents, you learn to round up to a nickel and then to a dime and a quarter, whatever you had. So you had a sense of where 32 cents fit on a number line, for example. Well, now, the person hands you a $20 bill and you enter $20 and it tells you how much change to give the person. There's no thought that goes into that. So there was one line that was moving faster than the others, and when I got in that line, because I was in a hurry, I got up front and saw it because the student had a pocket cash register. So that was a substitute for what she didn't otherwise have available. Also, I have to point out that almost everybody behind the counter was black, and almost everybody in the line was white, and racism cannot like that. We all had a ready explanation for what was wrong, but we left those dancers and learning instead. That was our category for understanding. It wasn't a computer problem, it was an educational problem, and it wasn't a problem with the school system, it was a problem with those kids. It was really riveting to watch this, to watch what the nature of the grumbling became when the problem was our problem all of a sudden, when the ghetto was in front of us and didn't serve us correctly. He understood what was happening. What we have is a school system that's falling apart, that isn't teaching kids math, that isn't teaching people basic business skills. And our solution is to build machines that don't require them to know any of those things, rather than improving the educational system. Now, how is McDonald's going to respond to the fact that this computer went down? By building a backup computer, so that the next time it won't go down. That's a solution that leaves it within their domain, and makes a lot of business sense. But if you think at the societal level, how much sense does it make? that we have, how has this technology been used in that situation? What kind of skills exactly has it brought to those secretaries? What kind of skills has it brought to the people that work in McDonald's? What are the larger consequences of the fact that we've allowed computers, this new technology, to be introduced in this way in school settings, or in any settings, in business settings? I have, one of the reasons this is particularly on my mind right now is that I have students in my class who are, I've been teaching computer programming for some years. The computers are getting better and better. When I first taught, I'm trying to be totally untechnical here, but remember when you're learning philosophy, they give you very simple principles and see if you can understand them, or logic, they see if you can deal with the easier things. Well, similarly, in a computer class, I will give the easiest kinds of problems to people to solve, so that they have to somehow write a program that will correctly notice what the sum of these three numbers is, just to see if they can make the machine act. Typically, when things go wrong, they don't go wrong with the computer. There's a sense in which these computers are highly reliable devices, but they go wrong with the person who's doing the program. Like, almost always, when they tell me there's something wrong with the computer, I look at what they've written. Now, several years ago, when the machines were relatively primitive and I was teaching the same class, when a student would do this, and they would figure out in their head what the answer was, and if the answer was 20, they'd know it. And so if they wrote the program and the program came up with the wrong answer, they'd know it was wrong. And they'd go back and check their work, and they'd reprogram and so on. These machines are now extraordinarily accessible, so these basic things you can get through with ease. I, for the first time in a couple of years, as machines get better and better, quote unquote, have computer programs turned into me by people that have an answer like 108 to a question like this, and they've not checked it. The computer has, we have made it so easy to do something that looks like addition that people no longer look back to notice that the machine isn't working. There's a certain, as McDonald's is, in my estimation, relying on those machines, and in a way that is disruptive and of education and doesn't allow us to face up to it, show these better machines are disruptive of education in these settings. I had to sit on these kids to get them. I said, don't turn in anything to me that doesn't have the right answer, because it's easy enough to check. So I got right answers, but the trouble is that mentality is taken to other classes. What's going on there? I think it's very important. It's another thing about writing. I don't know whether you, writing is now being solved in schools with word processors, and it's being solved with spelling checkers, and it's being solved with all kinds of, and not only that, you can call up a thesaurus these days, and if you've used the same word too many times, it will suggest a substitute. Okay, now what has this got to do with learning to write? If the station, if you spelled it wrong and it's garbage, I suggest that when you spell it correctly, because the computer has helped you, it's garbage. You've not learned anything. You've just made it more presentable on the other end. Somebody that I read an essay that I put together called Problems Which Word Processors Cannot Solve. I want to read this. This is somebody named Anders Henriksen, who teaches in Canada, but this is not about Canada, took a number of real sentences that have been turned into him in history classes at the freshman and sophomore level in college over the years, and put them into an essay. And let me read you some of the sentences. Now, these are, he chose them deliberately, but I'm presenting them deliberately. He says, and these are sentences, remember, from lots of different students. Like, history, as we know, is always biased because human beings have to be studied by other human beings, not by independent observers of another species. During the Middle Ages, everybody was middle-aged. Church and state were cooperative. Medieval society was made up of monks, lords, and serfs. It is unfortunate that we do not have a medieval European laid out on the table before us, ready for dissection. After the revival of infantile commerce slowly creeped into Europe, merchants appeared. Some were sitters and some were drifters. They roamed from town to town, exposing themselves and organizing big ferries in the countryside. Medieval people were violent. Murder during this period was nothing. Everybody killed someone. England fought numerously for land in France and ended up winning and losing. The Crusades were a series of military expeditions made by Christians seeking to free the home, the Holy Land, the hometown of God, from the Islam. Then I'll skip through some of this. The Middle Ages whimpered to a halt. The Renaissance bolted in from the blue. Life reeked with joy. Italy became robust, and more individuals felt the value of their human beings. Italy, of course, was much closer to the rest of the world thanks to Northern Europe. Man was determined to civilize himself and his brothers, even if heads had the role. It became chic to be educated. Art was on a more associated level. Europe was full of incredible churches with art bulging out their doors. Renaissance merchants were beautiful and almost lifelike. The Reformation happened when German nobles resented the idea that tithes were going to papal France or the Pope, thus enriching Catholic coiffures. Tradition became oppressive, so that they too were crushed in the wake of man's quest for resurrection above the not-so-just social beast he had become. An angry Martin Luther nailed 95 theocrats to a church pillar. Theologically, Luther was into reorientation mutations. Calvinism was the most convenient religion since the days of the ancients. Anabaptist services used to be migratory. The popes, of course, were usually Catholic. Monks went right on seeing themselves as worms. The last Jesuit priest died in the 19th century. The Enlightenment was a reasonable finalized justice. France was in a very serious state. The French Revolution was accomplished before it happened. The revolution evolved through monarchical, republican, and I'm trying to read these phrases, and Tolerian phases until it escapulted into Napoleon. Napoleon was ill and with bladder problems and was very tense and unrestrained. History, a record of things left behind by past generations, started in 1815. Throughout the comparatively radical years, 1815 to 1870, the Western European continent was undergoing a rapid period of economic modification. Industrialization was precipitating in England. Problems were so complexicated that in Paris, out of a city population of 1 million, 2 million able-bodies were on the loose. A new time zone of national unification roared over the horizon. Nationalism, talk about nationalism in Italy. We can see that nationalism succeeded, for Italy became France's biggest army. Napoleon III and the IV mounted the French throne, THROWN. One thinks of Napoleon III as an extension of the late but great Napoleon. Here, too, was the new Germany, loud, bold, vulgar, and full of reality. World War I broke out about 1912, 1911. Germany was on the side of France, and Russia was on the other. At war, people get killed, and then there aren't any people, any more people but friends. Peace was proclaimed at Versailles, which was attended by, and so on. President Wilson arrived with 14 pointers. In 1937, Lenin revolted Russia. Communism raged among the peasants, and the Civil War team colors were red and white. Germany was replaced after World War I. This gave rise to Hitler. Germany was morbidly overexcited and unbalanced. Berlin became a decadent capital where all terms of sexual deprivation were practiced. A huge anti-Semitic movement arrived. Attractive slogans like "Death to all Jews" were used by governmental groups. Hitler militarized the Rhineland over a skirmish between Germany and France. The appeasers were blinded by the great red of the Soviets. Mussolini rested his foundations on 8 million badass that invaded Haile Selassie. Germany dropped Poland, France invaded Belgium, and Russia invaded everybody. War screeched to a halt when a nuclear explosion was dropped in Hiroshima. A whole generation had been wiped out in two world wars, and their former families were left to pick up the pieces. According to Eric Fromm, individualization begins historically in medieval times. This is a period of small childhood. There was an increasing experience as adolescent experiences this big development. The last stage is us. Well, whatever the problem is here, it's not going to be solved by computers and word processors and better spelling. There's something more fundamental that has not only to do with these individual sentences, but what's going on in education such that these are answers. I receive them too. They're typically not organized coherently, but there's something about the way we're having technology be our intercessor, our intermediator to an educational system that's working hardly at all for these kids at McDonald's, working rather more poorly than I would like it to be at Northwestern where I am. And more generally, in shaping the way in which we think about things that I'm nervous about. This is not a doom story. I'm not, this is not prophetic in that way, but I do think we've given ourselves over to thinking that we have a problem that's going to be solved with technology. It's not a new thing to have thought. Or as Dan might say, has that ever happened before? But one of the things that worries me most is people aren't thinking about it. Even people who are nervous about it can't express what they're nervous about. They don't know what terminology to bring. They don't know what experience, whether the experience is worth against this technological impulse. I think there are a body of experiences we can build on now. And I just wanted to lay some of those out for you. But we got a little time. Let's see what questions people might have. I'm sorry to frustrate your questions. But, yeah.
In my experience, this tool, which can be used by any other tool, must be held intact by the person using it.
But what does the must be held mean? I mean, so is the atom bomb. I'm not sure, at what point is it no longer, when have we moved beyond philosophy to a practical domain where it's very hard to do? It is just a tool. It's an incredibly powerful tool. That's the good news and the bad news.
And the tool has been implemented to avoid making mistakes, because it would be proven that mistakes are less frequent if you can use buttons instead of and it's the same as lots of other things. You can blend in mistakes by using a tool which helps you to bypass mistake-prone events.
Well, I think that's right. I just, my sense as a true believer, I mean, I got to know a lot about computers to have done all this and to do all the work that Jody and I can talk about. My problem is we're there where the rubber hits the road. And when you see it manifested in real life, it often isn't as wonderful as one might
hope. Oh, I know.
Yeah. Yeah.
In my environment, I'm a lot of programs that drive the things. We kind of set a goal when we started writing these programs because they were individualized tools to force the people that were using them to have to know what they were doing before they used them. So we deliberately made places in the programs where people had to intercede and know their subject in order to that we would not. That they would at least have a chance of recognizing the wrong answer when it came out.
I've tried to do that. SPSS is an awful thing for the social sciences, as far as I'm concerned, because anybody can compute an answer.
The one thing that struck me with that was the kids coming out of college had that same problem you were talking about. They will accept an answer without challenging whether it's right or not. They even find ways to get around it. So
exactly. So they don't have to face up to the what they're wrong. They want to move on. They don't want to answer your question correctly in order to learn something. They want to answer it as a gatekeeper to getting on.
Yes.
But the reason they're there.
Yes.
Yeah.
So my argument is a linguist, a classic of Hebrew, Greek, and Greek, can write most precisely in Hebrew. And he is very frustrated at some of the new words that have crept into our language as a result of technology, like inputting, output. We did the other day at lunch, if I had to give any more input than I give any more output, I'm going to upthrow.
Another example of skilling, maybe the air traffic controllers nowadays are requiring them to not control traffic anymore, but to control the alarm system they have built in their computers now. They no longer have the experienced controllers thinking about moving this airplane across the sky. They're controlling the alarm system. These guys have had to kind of deep skill thinking in terms of I'm controlling airplanes, and now they're working with a computer.
Right.
And the only bad part about that is that pilots are still flying the airplanes, going fast sometimes, going slow sometimes, and it'll only work all when the airplanes are all driven by radios, you know, there are no pilots, then it'll work in with a few computers.
So if we get rid of people altogether,
Well, that's the only time that this new air traffic control thing will work.
There's this, you know, I didn't talk at all about what's happened to the jobs. You know, when they were introducing automation into Detroit, they were talking about all the jobs that were going to be eliminated, how efficient we could be, and then Walter Ruther said, who's going to buy your automobile? So if this whole issue, there's a book called Men and Termites that discusses the impact of computers in jobs for highly skilled professionals, in this case draftsmen, and how, you know, it can draw straight lines and curved lines better than they can, but what has that got to do with draftsmen? Just a small part. But people, once again, the things that get to define narrowly in terms of those things that are mechanically evident. I think we have to allow people to go, and then we can continue to talk. If there are any of these things you want to follow up on, I think you might find some useful readings in here. Thank you very much.